Makeshift Stories presents Somewhere, Sometime, an irregular series of short sci-fi and fantasy stories.
An alter ego is another self, a distinct second identity that can allow a person to lead a double life. Jane, a meek Java developer by day, is a crime-fighting superhero by night. But is it truly that simple? Can you just slip from one personality to another by finding the closest phone booth to make a quick costume change? In this month's story, a man who is woken by his dog in the middle of the night can't get back to sleep and finds himself reminiscing about the last conversation he had with his old friend Rob, a would-be graphic novelist who invented the supervillain, Dr. Plastic. We now invite you to sit back and relax as you listen to Makeshift Stories 77, The Return of Dr. Plastic. Somewhere in some time you might find yourself believing that a close friend's fantasy could be real. I was awake when the dog started barking at a ghost blowing down the street on the lip of an early fall wind, which was gone by the time I stiffly staggered to the window. I settled her down, tempting her back to her favorite cushion with a piece of leftover chicken from the fridge. Then, giving in to my insomnia, made tea and poured myself into a chair in the dining room. Eventually, my eyes drifted over to a framed illustration hung on the wall beside the table. It consisted of two comic panels rendered in a careless gestural style that was more suited to a first-year art school drawing class than a graphic novel. The caption in the upper right hand of the top panel read, "At the gyre, somewhere in the Pacific Ocean, Dr. Plastic unleashes streams of polycarbonate debris mixed with his own secret sauce." Gyre was misspelt. In the bottom panel, a crudely drawn, desperate-looking Dr. Plastic laughed uncontrollably while he floated on an anti-grav platform surrounded by hundreds of robotic minions. They all held little fire hoses that were spewing out tons of goop into the water, which instantly absorbed the plastic garbage trapped in the gyre to form a quickly spreading island. There were two dialogue boxes over the supervillain's head. "Ha ha ha," the first one started. Then the larger one continued. "The world doesn't care about plastic, and that will be humanity's downfall. Look how my new empire grows. Soon, it will cover all the world's oceans, and no one can stop me. No one will even think to, until it's too late." It was strange how one could acknowledge something without really looking at it for such a long time, I mused. Then remembered the night I met Dr. Plastic, a.k.a. Richard Smith, a.k.a. Rob Stepanski. Rob hailed from the north end of Central City, a working-class area with a large Eastern European population. We met in college when we were both taking a commercial art diploma. I was in graphic design, and Rob in illustration. At the time, I lived in an old apartment facing out onto one of the rivers that divided the city into three distinct areas: the wealthy South, the French East, and the working class North. I was lucky to share a unit that faced the riverbank with a separate entrance through the kitchen from a wooden staircase that spidered up the side of the old brick building. And that was the door that Rob banged on, waking me up at 2 a.m. on a work night. Back then I was employed by a small ad agency as an art director, an hour's bus ride to get to, so a 2 a.m. visit was not very welcome. When I answered the insistent pounding to the protests of my roommate, Rob burst through the door into the kitchen, hoisting a 2-4 of beer onto the table and dropping a thick rolled-up sheaf of paper secured with two elastics down beside it. He had been working on a remote northern rail crew, and it was his first few hours back in town.
"I didn't expect to see you back here until October,"
I said with a consciously limited amount of enthusiasm, following him over to the small kitchen table, indicating that he should keep his voice as low as possible. Ignoring my request, Rob pointed to the paper scroll and loudly pronounced,
"I drew them up north. We weren't close to any towns this year, so I had lots of time at night. It's my new book, the one I started last winter."
"I'm glad you got so much done,"
I quietly encouraged, indicating with my hands that he needed to keep his voice down. Rob had been trying to publish a graphic novel ever since I'd met him, but his loose, messy style and writing skills were significant barriers.
It had been 7 years since college, and although he had completed 5 books and was now working on a 6th, the closest he had come to publishing was to make a few photocopies and try and sell them at craft fairs. Back then, Usenet consisted of only a few hundred academic computers, and the web was still over 10 years into the future. So self-publishing consisted of exactly what Rob was doing, very small scale and hyper-local. "Take a look," Rob encouraged. I reached over and carefully slipped the elastics off the paper and unrolled the drawings. The top sheet, the one now hanging beside my dining room table, was signed, "For Frank," from Robert. I put it to one side, and underneath, in Rob's loose style, was a cover for his new book. While I was doing this, Rob loudly rummaged through the kitchen cabinets. Finally locating a bottle opener, he popped the caps off 2 beers, which he plunked down on the table between us.
"Thanks for the drawing, Rob,"
I said, flipping the cover over to reveal the sheet underneath. The first frame on the next page showed a frantic-looking character racing through an apartment ripping down pictures. The caption read, "Disguised as Richard Smith, an ordinary cable TV installer living in Central City, Dr. Plastic checks his apartment for listening devices."
"How was your summer?" I asked,
trying to take control of the conversation.
"Lots of flies and mosquitoes. Look."
Rob rolled up one sleeve, revealing a recovering, well-chewed arm.
"A short season this year, but it's still enough to qualify me for unemployment over the winter."
I tried to think of something positive to say, but could only come up with a lame response.
"That sounds great."
Although I knew it wasn't. There was a sad harmonic in his voice that said the annual descent into near-indentured labor each summer had its price. And in payment, he had to disgorge a part of his soul somewhere along the tracks in the bush, like a piece of discarded slag from an old steam engine.
"I mostly kept to myself this year. I liked it when everyone finally went into town. Then I could get some peace, no one physically looking over my shoulder, if you know what I mean. I could work undisturbed if I kept the windows on the crew car shuttered."
He tapped a calloused finger with a grease-stained nail on the unrolled stack of drawings. When had his hands changed so much, I wondered. They used to be as delicate as a pianist's. Rob continued.
"Around the beginning of June, I kept finding stuff in the bush only about 50 feet away from the tracks. Mostly robotic eyes, disguised as flowers. Very expensive tech, very hard to get. And something moved them every time we changed the location of the camp. I don't know how they found me, but they tracked us the whole summer."
I knew he wanted me to challenge him on this point, so he could go right back to that troubled place, but I didn't. I had hoped several months away would have brought him around, allowing him to clear his mind and see things as they actually were. The clue that instead it had just festered away was the first frame of his new book. I should have realized that immediately, but instead, in an attempt to avoid it, I changed the subject. Pulling the stack of drawings toward me, I asked,
"Hey, tell me about the new book. It looks almost finished."
I added, thumbing through the pages. Rob immediately brightened, grabbing the drawings away from me and placing the cover back on the stack.
It's called Escape to the Plastic Citadel. It's the final installment. Dr. Plastic reveals his true identity, and he's forced to build his own fortress of solitude in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Rob pulled a panel out of the stack that was almost a duplicate of the one he'd given me.
"I had no choice," he insisted. "After all, Dr. Plastic polluted the Great Lakes in Book 5 by stealing the world's supply of plastic microbeads, then resold them to the soap and cosmetic industry as a cheap exfoliating additive, and the government got suspicious and started to spy on him, trying to figure out whom his human alter ego is. Remember?"
It's been a while since I read it,"
I lied. I'd only paged through Book 5 once during a late night similar to this one.
"It was called The Revenge of Dr. Plastic or something like that, right?"
"The Revenge of Micropolyethylene," Rob corrected, with a hint of irritation in his voice. I almost apologized for my faulty memory, then realized he was the one who had woken me up at 2 a.m. on a work night. So instead I kept silent and impatiently waited for him to continue.
"Guess that means I'll have to add a short version of the origin story at the front, for some of my more casual readers. Rob mumbled, glaring in a way that made me feel like I had deeply betrayed him. "It will probably need to go something like this," he began. "Dr. Plastic arrived on Earth by accident. His parents, in a desperate attempt to save their only son, had sealed him into a life pod and shot it towards Saturn's moon Titan, the closest planetary-sized object that had a hydrocarbon cycle similar to their own imperiled world. They and a colony of scientists were to follow after him, but when their son went nova sooner than they had predicted, the shockwave from the explosion nudged their tiny fleet of escaping spacecraft off course, so they never arrived in Sol System. Meanwhile, due to a mistake during the hasty preparations, Dr. Plastic's pod's trajectory was ever so slightly miscalculated. As a result, 5,000 years later, when the hatch popped open, a young Yersinian boy found himself stranded in the middle of a crater melted into the Barnes ice cap on Baffin Island, tragically on a hot world covered with molten water. You could never imagine how painful it is to burn your hand on scorching hot water ice, especially for a young frightened boy who didn't know any better, can you? Rob accused. But I know what it's like. Anyway, after accidentally burning most of his skin on the water ice, the young Dr. Plastic returned to his tiny pod and put himself in hibernation while the ship's AI worked on the problem. The machine intelligence eventually decided to seal the young Yersinian in a permanent second skin of impregnable heat-resistant plastic. Unconsciously, Rob pinched a bit of skin on his mosquito-bitten forearm, noticed what he was doing, then corrected his statement. Well, actually, he was really sealed in a layer of artificial plastic-like skin that deflected the heat of this hot water world. Impregnability would have been a good idea, but it's too late for that. You can't change what has already happened.
Sure you can, I hopefully suggested. It happens all the time in fiction. You just need to add a few backstory panels that explain what happened.
Good idea, Rob said, staring at his arm again. The impregnable capacity of the skin was damaged by solar radiation. There was that big hole in the ozone layer over the Arctic, you know. It makes perfect sense. That's what probably happened. I should have thought of that. Thanks.
Rob thoughtfully smiled.
Book one only starts after Dr. Plastic left the Arctic and was building his alter ego, Rick Smith, as he attended community college. So there's a bit of wiggle room in the origin story, only a bit. I don't want to stray too far from the facts.
My sleep-starved mind finally started to come alive, and I began to remember. The first book was the only one in the series I had completely read. Rob had been in a better state of mind back then, until a failed attempt to date one of our former classmates hurled him into a manic state. After that, he created Dr. Plastic. At the time, I thought it would be a good focus for him. He needed something positive in his life. His drawing style was making it hard for him to find a job.
Yeah, I remember now,
I quietly chirped.
Dr. Plastic used the college's electronics lab to build a time machine, but instead of sending him back in time and space so he could correct the navigational error that sent him to Earth, the machine only kicked him back 50 years. So he made the best of the situation and decided to steal a patent on plastic wrapping, then returned to the late 1970s, where he started the Great Packaging Material Wars. He helped plastic eventually win out, displacing cardboard and paper, making him fabulously wealthy in the process.
I smiled, proud of myself for remembering the story.
And that's when the environmental groups got into the game, Rob groused. They wanted to figure out who I, he started to say before correcting himself, Dr. Plastic's alter ego was, so they could take him to court and sue him. And that's why he needed a disguise. That is, it worked up until recently. After all, who would suspect a semi-employed cable TV installer living in a bachelor apartment in the north end of Central City?
He looked glum again.
Those devices in the forest I found this summer.
Not wanting him to stray back to that dark state of paranoia, I cut Rob off, directing the conversation back to the book.
Tell me more about the new story.
Well, he began, it's important to understand first that Dr. Plastic was never really understood. Plastic was a naturally occurring material on this native hydrocarbon-saturated world, where the mountains were capped with polystyrene snow that accumulates from the heavy petrochemical rains. So what was the problem with making plastic? Nothing. It's as natural as dirt, and it's beautiful. To him, anyway. Covering the world with it would be something like, well, replanting a forest on Earth. So Dr. Plastic never understood the resistance to his work and why the world cast him as a villain. No one understands. Not even now. Dr. Plastic is still shunned and despised for just being himself. An alien. Plastic microbeads suspended in water. Rob mused, nervously fingering his stack of drawings. Did you know that when the sun shines through them, they refract the light into the most beautiful underwater rainbows? The scientists never even bothered to look at that. They just dissected a few fish in the Great Lakes and started to freak out when they found plastic beads. And that's when the governments took notice and started to spy on anyone who they even remotely suspect is connected to Dr. Plastic. They intensified the hunt for his alter ego. Think what that's like, Frank, with both environmental groups and the government hot on your trail like cyborg bloodhounds that won't give up. Things are getting pretty tough, and tough times spawn desperate acts. And that's where it starts. Rob stopped to take a swig of beer, emptying the bottle. He had that focused look in his eye which said that at the moment nothing existed beyond the reality he was describing. It was a look I had hoped never to see again. Unaware of my growing discomfort, Rob forged ahead. Yeah, so in book 6, well, it's time to get out of here. Time to escape to somewhere no one really cares about. To finally build a new world where life is kinder and that sort of thing. Where only people who understand and appreciate the sublime elegance of polycarbonates will be allowed. So I figured, if you can't get off the planet, where is the best place to be? The Great Pacific Gyre, of course, where all the carelessly abandoned plastic eventually ends up. It's a perfect place. And do you know the craziest thing about it? He didn't wait for an answer. The crazy thing is that while the world treats Dr. Plastic like a criminal, everyone just chucks their plastic bottles and bags into the ocean, then blames him when the fish they eat are full of the stuff. Rob dropped his voice. However much they vilify me, they're doing my bidding anyway, building my plastic citadel, one carelessly discarded bottle and bag at a time. And all I have to do is enhance the process a bit by adding a pre-programmed assembler molecule to the mix. Rob laughed, pulling a sheet from the middle of the stack. I stared at it. He had recited the caption word for word without looking at the panel. A shiver suddenly ran up my spine. I hadn't seen him so obsessed since the time I had tried to talk him out of going after a mutual friend, whom Rob claimed had been following him around. It's out there right now, Frank, growing. Imagine an empire of polyethylene constantly growing. 80 million tons of it are made and dumped every year. That's 219,000 tons a day, or 152 tons every minute. It just grows and grows, and it will be too late by the time someone figures it out. In the meantime, they'll waste their time hunting for the poor doctor's alter ego. It's a fabulous plot, and a great plan. Dr. Plastic stops hiding behind Richard Smith, and then the world finally knows the face of its new master. Rob pulled another page out and turned it around for me to see. It showed a silhouetted figure standing on a mountain of discarded plastic, hands on hips, a cape billowing behind in the breeze, with the caption, "Out from the shadows at last, Dr. Plastic finally reveals himself." "A cape?" I questioned, barely containing a laugh. Looking hurt, Rob snarled, "Come on, even supervillains can have a cape. There's no rule against that. And it's made from flexible bulletproof polycarbonates. I've always wanted one." For a second, I thought he was going to pull a cape out of his backpack. And so it went, the late night progressing to the early morning, as Rob explained the new book, mixing his own life with his fictional creation until the two started to become one. And me? I tried to keep him from sliding back to the dark pit of paranoia that he had fallen into over the last few years, filled with delusions of persecution, television sets that watched you, walls with ears, and phones that tracked your every step. It was almost 5 a.m. when my patients finally gave up and went back to bed, leaving me to fend for myself.
"Rob,"
I blurted out,
"stop." Obviously, going north this summer didn't help. I was hoping that getting away from the depressing room you were living in would reset things for you. There was no one spying on you last winter, and no one in the bush this summer. That guy we both went to college with, you know, the one you claimed had moved in down the hall from you, the one you said insinuated his way into your place to plant bugs, remember? You told me about it last March. Well, I ran into him while you were away. He can barely recall who you are, and he's not even living in the same part of the city. Rob, you need to see someone about this. I've tried, I really have, but this is beyond me and beyond you. You've got to get help.
You, Frank, of all people, should understand. Rob barked, balling his hands into fists, then banging them on the table. He quickly gathered his drawings and roughly rolled them up, considered using them as a club to sweep the empty bottles off the table, then reconsidered and slipped the roll into his coat pocket, then stood up. I could tell that he was barely under control, and for the first time felt physically intimidated by him. Rob was at least a head taller and had 50 pounds on me. He just stood there and in a deep, trembling voice screamed, "They've gotten to you too, haven't they? There's a camera or a mic or something like that here. They've recorded everything I've said, and they know who I really am, and thanks to you now, they know what I'm going to do next. You've betrayed me, Frank." Rob turned noisily, bumping into chairs, then slammed the door shut and clumped down the wooden stairs so loudly that I heard angry bangs of protest from the neighbors below us. I sat there for a moment, stunned and relieved, but feeling guilty that I hadn't done enough to help him, that indeed I had failed him. I didn't talk to Rob again after that night, but occasionally heard bits and pieces through the odd person who had run across him at a public market or outside a mall, flogging his graphic novels, and I even thought I saw him once on the other side of a busy street, barely recognizable through an overgrown beard. His unmistakable loping gait gave him away. One shoulder sagged under a heavy canvas bag marked with the faded logo of a defunct local newspaper. I like to imagine that the bag was full of copies of Dr. Plastic. Eventually lured away by new opportunities, I left Central City and hadn't really thought about Rob or Dr. Plastic until now. Curious, I pulled my tablet out from under a stack of flyers and turned it on. The plastic and glass slab obediently jumped to life, bathing my face in the cold, precise light of thousands of tiny LCDs. I tapped open a browser and thumb-typed into the address bar between two quotation marks, "Dr. Plastic." After plodding through dozens of pages of results for plastic surgeons, liposuction, and lawsuits for the proceeding, I found nothing. Disappointed, I was about to close the browser when I decided to take the search engine's advice. Results for Dr. Plastic without quotation marks, and immediately found a 4-year-old news story titled, "Japanese Fishermen Find Mysterious Object in Pacific Gyre." 5 Japanese fishermen who were blown off course by a late-season typhoon claim to have spotted an enormous building shrouded in mist floating on the water at the center of the plastic debris in the Great Pacific Gyre. They claim their attempts to investigate were thwarted by a mysterious current that pushed them back out to sea. The dog, which had apparently only been pretending to sleep, suddenly barked, jumping out of her seat, pasting her nose to the patio doors facing the front street, fogging the glass with her excited snorts. This time, I managed to get to the window fast enough to just catch the glimpse of a shadow with what looked like a cape flit out of sight, chased by 2 plastic grocery bags, and the faint sound of rustling polyethylene.
"He's back, Annie,"
I whispered to my dog, calming her with a scratch behind her ears.
Thanks for listening to Makeshift Stories 77, The Return of Dr. Plastic. We hope that you've enjoyed this month's episode. As always, if you like what we're doing, please tell your friends about us, or write a review on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also go over to our Google Plus page at plus.google.com/the+ sign and makeshift stories. We love hearing your comments, so send us an email to makeshiftstories@gmail.com or visit our website at makeshiftstories.com. If you're looking for more great speculative fiction podcasts, but are tired of wading through iTunes only to find dead feeds and disappointing episodes, we'd recommend checking out Synthetic Voices. Each month, podcast critic Jimmy Rogers recommends a few of his favorite episodes from among a wide variety of FS podcasts. So head over to sciencesmagic.com to discover new, free, engaging stories. To listen to Makeshift Stories on your iOS, Android device, or in your car, please download Stitcher Radio from iTunes or the Google Play Store. This month's story was written and read by Alan V. Hare. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution, No Derivative License, which means that you're free to share our stories, just remember to credit us and don't alter anything.